for inviting me to this very nice place. My talk will be split in two parts. Main part will be about quantum field body dynamics and how this is related to outer seconds will become clear during the talk. Because part of the audience are plasma physicists, I felt obliged to say something about plasma physics. So the last 5 to 10 minutes will be about quantum classical many-body dynamics and relations to outer second physics. So to start off, central to intense laser field physics is the singly active electron approximation. And here you see a schematic. This is a diatomic molecule, an electron which gets tunnel ionized, equilibrium motion, and some interaction during the recollision. And most of these problems are treated in the singly active electron approximation. So let me first discuss where the singly active electron approximation is good. Well, there is no doubt in the equilibrium motion, it is okay. The electron is far enough away from the nucleus, it's a one electron problem. Now it's different during the recollision. There is an interaction between the incoming electron and the bound electrons. And during my talk, I will revisit the following processes: harmonic generation with respect to multi-electron effects, non-sequential ionization with respect to multi-electron effects, and finally, I will investigate the multi-electron effects in tunnel ionization and the quality of the singly active electron approximation, where it can be applied and where it cannot be applied. So let me start off with harmonic generation. Here is the principal model. We have the three-step process, which is ionization, acceleration, recollision, recombination, and emission of the harmonic photon. Now, David and Paul from NRC, they observed that the recombination is determined by the recombination dipole matrix element between the highest occupied molecular orbital and between the plane wave, which is the electron coming in. And by making this observation, they found out that this can be used to reconstruct the molecular orbital of the molecule. How is this done? When you know ionization, when you know propagation, you factor these steps out. You're just left with the dipole matrix element. And as you see, this K is here nothing else than a Fourier transform. So in principle, when you have the measured data, you do an inverse Fourier transform, and you have measured a molecular orbital. How is this done experimentally? You take the molecule in a strong laser field, you rotate it slowly. During each position, you create a harmonic snapshot, and then you retrieve the HOMO from this data by inverse Fourier transformation and some other stuff. And here you see the experimental results, the HOMO measured, and here you see the HOMO as calculated by a quantum chemistry code. And you immediately see it looks similar, but it's not the same. So there clearly is some ingredient missing. Now, what is missing? Here again, that's the singly active electron approximation model of harmonic generation. The electron is coming in, it recombines with the HOMO, emits radiation in which the HOMO is encoded. Now, if you want to go beyond the singly active electron approximation, the next step would be you substitute the HOMO by the full n-body bound state electron wave function, and you substitute the plane wave by a tensor product of the ionic bound state wave function times the plane wave electron coming in. So that's the first simple step in going from singly active electron approximation to a multi-electron model. When you do that, you get two contributions. One is the singly active electron contribution, and the second one is an exchange contribution in which the incoming electron can recombine to a deeper level, and the deeper core electron goes up to the HOMO. So that means you not only see the HOMO, you also get some of the core orbitals mixed in. Now let me show you whether this works or not. Here you see again Paul's and David's experiments. Here you see again the HOMO is calculated from a quantum chemistry code. And here you see a high harmonic generation calculated from the multi-electron dipole moment I showed you before, and the wave function retrieved from this dipole moment. And you immediately see this works much better, which is, I would say, a strong indication that multi-electron effects in terms of exchange effects play a role in high harmonic generation. So the single active electron approximation, at least in the recombination, is not a good approximation. And if you want a quantitative description of this process, you have to incorporate these effects. Now, if you can stop at that level, you're fairly well off. This is, I would say, a very simple approximation, which can be easily done. When you look at recombination, the problem gets much harder. Then you really have to look at the interaction between the two electrons and the full dynamics, and you face two theoretical challenges. One is fewer many-body physics. You have to calculate the fully correlated system. And the second is non-perturbative dynamics. And both together are a very, very hard problem to tackle. As an introduction, let me give you a background on the various theoretical tools we use to solve this problem. We can start with the exact solution, which would be a six-dimensional wave function for a two-electron system. If you use 1,000 points in one dimension, you have 10 to the 18 points in six dimensions. That's called the curse of dimensions that completely kills you. There's no way of doing that. There are, of course, people who do it a little smarter, who expand these wave functions. So in principle, two electrons can be done to a certain degree at the moment. But when you want to go to more electrons, there is absolutely no way of calculating the full few-body electron wave function. Now, which other methods are there? One is Hartree-Fock. In Hartree-Fock, you split up the multi-electron wave function in single-electron products. You anti-symmetrize the wave function because electrons are spin particles, spin half particles. Second method is density functional. Again, you split up the wave function in single electron wave functions, and you try to account for correlation and interaction effects by density functional. The third method is configuration interaction, where you take not only one configuration but many configurations. You fix the basis set. And in Hartree-Fock, you optimize these one electron wave functions. In density functional, you optimize the one electron wave functions. And as I said, in configuration interaction, you fix the basis and you optimize the coefficients. Now, all three methods work to a certain degree in the weakly perturbative limit, where your bound system is weakly perturbed. When you go to stronger fields and to non-perturbative dynamics, electron gets ionized, recollides, and you get all this weird data, then all of the three methods fail. Hartree-Fock, time-dependent Hartree-Fock, includes correlation to a certain degree, but by far not enough to describe these dynamics. Density functional theory, the theorists know that the functional must exist, but they don't know how it looks, so that's a problem. And in configuration interaction, you have to describe a huge dimensional space which forces you to use an unreasonably large basis, which is just not possible. So that's not doable. So one solution out of that is a multi-configuration where you not only optimize the coefficients, but you optimize the coefficients and the single electron basis set. And this is originally Armin's idea. It builds on an idea from the Heidelberg group, and we have been working at that for the last 3 or 4 years. Let me show you how good this idea is. So first of all, once the code was working, we started with the simplest problem, which is two electrons in one dimension, helium. And here you see recollision data, which is two electron ionization. One electron gets ionized, bangs into the helium ion, two electrons fly away. And you see recollision as a function of the number of single electron wave functions used. And the number of Hartree-Fock configurations is essentially n over 2. Well, you see for n is 1, which would be Hartree-Fock, you don't see much. There is practically no non-sequential ionization. When you increase n, n is 15, you get some. Increase further, n is 45, you get more. And here, this is the exact solution. So when you look at the probability or the ionization rates, then you see that the ionization rate converges with the number of configurations, which is a good sign. So the code is doing something reasonable. The problem is, when you look at the two-electron continuum wave function from 15 to 45 to the exact result, you see it doesn't really converge. So that was a little disappointing. On the other hand, the one-dimensional system is an unnatural system, and the electrons interact much more than they should be in reality in a 3D system. So we thought if we scale up the code from one dimension to two dimensions, there might be hope to get better results. And this is what we did recently. The code is working now in two dimensions for a couple of particles. And the first problem we started to study is non-sequential ionization N2. Those are experiments from the Seidler group, from the Corcum group and the Frankfurt group. And what they did is they looked at N2 aligned with the electric field ones parallel to the molecular axis and the electric field perpendicular to the molecular axis. For 40 femtosecond pulse, 10 to the 14th watt per centimeter squared. And because what you get when you measure the electron momenta is a six-dimensional data field that you can't plot, you have to thin out the information. What they've plotted here is the momentum of electron A parallel to the electric field and the momentum of electron B parallel to the electric field. And just to give you a flavor of the physics, what you see in the first and in the third quadrant is an electron coming in, banging out another electron, the two leave instantaneously. What you see in the second and fourth quadrant is an electron coming in, exciting the other electron, electron goes off, and the other electron waits in an excited state until the electric field bends down the barrier, and then it escapes. And you see differences between the alignment parallel and perpendicular to the laser field. When it's parallel, then you see a higher probability at larger momenta than perpendicular, and you see essentially more of these events than in the perpendicular case. Now, what I'm showing you is very preliminary data. Those are runs which just finished last week, and I'm not even sure whether they are correct, but I think they're worth showing as a basis for discussion over the next 2 weeks. So these are our theoretical results. Here you again see Ka parallel and Kb parallel. It's not for 40 femtoseconds, it's for a 5 femtosecond pulse and a little higher intensity. And what you see is when you increase the number of wave functions, this time it seems to converge. So the two-dimensional problem seems to be more benign than the one-dimensional problem. You see the more configurations you add, the better you can resolve these high momentum components. So that's the first point I wanted to make. Second point, it's fairly hard to compare with the experiments. First question is, why do we only get the signal here, not here and here? The reason is we are using a really short pulse, so there is only one return in one direction. It's on the one side. We don't get the return on the other side. The second is, because we have a much better resolution than experiment, we get here some subcyclic structure. I don't really know what that means, but I think it's connected to some other second phenomena. I have to start to think about the physics of that. The third point I want to make, when we look at the perpendicular, unfortunately, we don't have the 10 wave functions here, so this is not yet converged. I would expect for the 10 wave functions that you get more probability here and a little more probability here. But you see, for the perpendicular, more probability is moving over in the second, fourth quadrant, which means return, excitation, electron weights, and then flies off, which is also in qualitative agreement with the experiment. So the baseline here is, I think, there's really hope in two dimensions to converge these systems, to study 2, 3, 4 electron dynamics, and to understand the physics. Let me give you some facts on the code. This code was written by a master student of mine, who is incredibly talented. The main enemy you have is the electron-electron interaction. This is in 3 dimensions, a 6-dimensional integral. In our case, it's a 4-dimensional integral. How this is usually done is you expand the electron-electron interaction in 2 two-dimensional functions. We are not doing that. You're solving the full integral by convolution. The reason being is we wanted to calculate the interaction as accurate as possible. As a result of that, we can resolve the Coulomb cusp, at least technically. Practically, we cannot do it. The reason is in 2 dimensions, you always need a shielding parameter to adapt your system to experimental quantities like ionization potential and binding energy. We calculate the Laplace operator also by Fourier transform, and we propagate in the momentum domain. Because we do everything in Fourier transform, the derivatives and all these calculations, so the Laplacian is calculated more accurate, so we can use a smaller momentum space, and as a result of the smaller momentum space, we can choose larger time steps in the propagation, so we win there. The calculation is done on a single 64-bit processor. Now the rate is fairly shocking. We can calculate 1 frame per second per day, so it's not really fast. How many 2D electrons are we able to do in one processor? I would say up to 4. It depends on the number of wave functions we have to use. Can we do 3D with this code? I would say maybe. The code scales on a shared memory processor structure. That has to be explored. So we didn't parallelize the code yet. It's still running on a single processor. So the future will show. So let me come to the third part, which is tunnel ionization of complex materials. This is not a numerical part. This is analytical work we did recently. Here is what people did so far. Tunnel ionization started in 1928, so it's fairly old, up to here. And all this work relied on a single active electron approximation. Now, there is sufficient data which shows this single electron approximation does not work in complex molecules. What people do in experiments, they take these complex systems, they change the intensity, they look at the ion signal as a function of intensity. In the linear regime, they extrapolate the ionization results, and at the point of intersection with the x-axis, they determine the saturation intensity. So what you see here is the experimental saturation intensity over ADK saturation intensity, and you see the two are apart by a factor of 2 to 3. It may sound small, but saturation intensity differing by a factor of 3 means orders of magnitude different ionization rates. So this is really going wrong. Now, again, our idea was that multi-electron effects are responsible for the difference between ADK theory and experiments. So we started to develop to extend ADK theory to a multi-electron picture. Now let me start with what ADK theory does. Here you have a schematic. That's the bound state. That's the barrier, the Coulomb barrier plus the laser electric field. You do an analytical WKP solution under the barrier, and then you match it to the bound state wave function, and you get the rate which describes ionization. If you want to go to the multi-electron case, you have to look at two effects, two multi-electron effects. One is the tunnel electron leaving here acts back on the core, so the core feels the ionizing electron plus the laser field. By these forces, the core is changed, and the core again acts back on the tunneling electron. Now, if you want to describe these two effects, you need a correlated ansatz. Here, capital R is the electron coordinates of the ion core. Small r is the electron coordinate of the tunneling electron. What people usually do is they use a product ansatz of the ion core and of the tunneling electron. What we add here is a correlation. So the wave function, the ion core, also depends on the coordinate of the tunneling electron. Now once you have this ansatz, you insert it in the Schrödinger equation, you do your analysis, and you get the final equation. And before you start solving this final equation, you can make three interesting points. The first point is Stark shift determining tunnel ionization is the difference between the Stark shift of the ion and the Stark shift of the neutral. So whenever these two Stark shifts are similar, approximately the same, you have no Stark shift in ionization. Second point is we get a single electron potential. It's an effective electron potential, which accounts for all the multi-electron effects appearing during the interaction of the tunneling electron and the core. So you see here, term by term, that's the Coulomb potential. This is the laser polarization. This is the image charge. And that's the angular momentum barrier. And essentially, the laser polarization is mainly responsible for reducing ionization in complex systems. The third point is, out of our theory, we can describe how the ion core realigns when the electron tunnels. So let me comment a little further on point two and point three. Why on point two? Because during the last two or three talks I gave, Andre asked me every time for intuitive picture why polarization reduces ionization, and I never could answer it. So I thought it's time to sit down, come up with a reasonable explanation. What you see here is the molecule. Here is the laser electric field force. And you see the force polarizes the molecule. You have the negative charges here and the positive charges here. Now when you think of that in terms of force, you come to the wrong result, because you would think negative force repels the electron, pushes it out, and enhances ionization. That's not the best way of thinking about it. It's better to think about it in terms of potential. Let me start with what the Coulomb potential does. The Coulomb potential is a positive charge. It binds the electron. Therefore, it brings down the potential as compared to the laser electric field. Bringing down the potential means lowering the barrier, enhancing ionization. The polarization is a negative charge, which means it reduces binding. Reducing binding means it increases the potential above the laser electric field. Now, increasing the potential means it increases the barrier and makes tunneling more difficult. I hope it answers your question. Well, we'll see. Okay. Now let me come to the third point. How does the ion reconfigure during tunnel ionization? It reconfigures following this simple equation. You see the ion feels also the laser polarizability, and it also feels the image charge. And I've schematically plotted this dependence here as a function of the electron distance from the ion core. See, when the electron is far away, the ion potential goes over to the undressed potential. When the electron is close to the nucleus, it goes over to the neutral binding energy. And in between, it feels the image charge and the polarizability. Now, the nice thing about that is you could imagine an experiment where you induce tunnel ionization and you probe the ion core. If you can resolve this energy shift of the ion binding energy, then you can step by step watch the wave function of the electron going out. So this would be a suggestion for an outer second experiment. Whether you really can resolve it, I don't know, but I would like to think about that further. All right. So now we have a single effective electron potential. Now we can do the same as WKP, ADK, and CD did. We solved the WKP solution for this new potential. We calculate the wave function of the bound state by some methods, such as density functional theory. We match the WKP solution to this wave function at this point, and we get the quasi-analytical theory of tunnel ionization. Under certain conditions, so quasi-analytical means it depends on one simple integral, which is easy to evaluate. under certain conditions, this integral can be done analytically, and you get the extended ADK formula, which is the ADK tunnel ionization rate, plus additional factors coming from the angular momentum barrier, from laser polarization, and from the image charge. Now let me show you how good this model is. We've compared it to C60. How the experiment is done is, Paul and his group uses 70 femtosecond laser pulse. They increase the intensity. With increasing intensity, they ionize more and more of the charge states over the laser pulse. Why is this important? Because C60 undergoes a Jahn-Taylor symmetry breaking from the charge state 2 to larger than 2. And that changes the configuration. And we don't really know how fast this configuration changes. So it might be that for a set larger 2, we are still in this configuration because tunnel ionization occurs before it can reconfigure. It might be this reconfiguration is very fast, and we have to look at this system for C larger than 2. And the measurements are again done as explained before. They measure the saturation intensity. We do the same thing. You see, actually, the experiment agrees fairly well with the theory. For sets 1 and 2, it agrees really well. This is without angular momentum barrier, so here the largest part is angular momentum barrier. Here, the dominant part is not angular momentum barrier, it's polarizability. And this would be, by comparison, ADK, MOADK. Here it's a large difference. It's a smaller difference, but it's still a factor of 2, which would translate in orders of difference in ionization rate. Because I'm running out of time, I'm skipping the next one. And the next one, and come to my plasma physics part. There's one universal property of many body systems when you go from the small diatomic molecules to larger systems, which is collective effects versus collisional phenomena. You find them everywhere. Plasma physics, clusters, nuclear physics, atomic physics, they are debated, and in large molecules. So let me take the plasma as an example. There you have the regime of a weakly coupled plasma, which is hot and dilute. Collective plasma effects dominate. Traditional plasma theory works. We have the strongly coupled plasma, which is cold and dense, where the collisions dominate. And the parameter which distinguishes between the two is the electron-ion coupling parameter. Now, we thought it would be nice to make an experiment where you first can tune the transition from the weakly to the strongly coupled plasma. And because strongly coupled plasma has a dynamics on an attosecond scale, also resolve these dynamics. So the idea is to take a cluster, prepare it by a strong laser pulse, tailor the coupling parameter as a function of laser intensity, and then attosecond pump probe it in some way. Calculations are done by a tree code, plus rates for quantum processes. To make it short, here you see in principle, in the calculations it works. That's the electron-ion coupling parameter as a function of laser intensity. And you make the transition between 10 to the 16 and 10 to the 15, you make the transition between a weakly and a strongly coupled plasma. And the nice thing is, running out? Okay. All right. That's enough time. The nice thing is you change the collision frequency by changing the laser intensity, and you leave the plasma frequency relatively unchanged. So the collective effects are unchanged. You just change the collisional effects. So then in the computer, we did such an experiment. We prepared the plasma, and then we did the pump probe, watching the plasmons decay. That's a fairly busy graph. You see here the numerical calculations for two cluster sizes, 5,000 and 500. That's this curve. The first observation is this is surface independent. That's good and bad news. Good news in the sense that surface independent means we can compare the effects to true plasma theory, which has no surface. And that we have done. This is the Spitzer rate. And you see at low gamma EI, it works very well. And then at gamma EI larger than 0.3, it fails because the Coulomb logarithm fails. And this talk I gave in February in Rostock, and I had it up to here, and some plasma physicists saw it and said, yes, pizza, well, that's old stuff. We can do better than that. And then we started the cooperation. and they calculated the electron-ion collision rates for a strongly coupled plasma, and this is their result. You see that does much better. So it's a fairly good agreement. They use many body theory, second-order bond approximation, but here the difference is still a factor of two, so I guess to really get good agreement, they would have to go to higher and higher orders. Now, when you look at the decay, there is a disappointing thing. The disappointing thing is the decay is just exponential. That's boring. You could also resolve by loss absorption spectroscopy. So why is that so? The reason is that we have no surface. Why do we have no surface? Because during preparation, we heat out some of the electrons. The remaining electron cloud shrinks, and it never touches the surface. So in some sense, that is good because we can compare it to traditional plasma physics, but in terms of interesting attosecond dynamics, it's not so good. What we would have to do is go here to even lower intensities, then we enter the quantum degenerate plasma regime where it becomes more metal-like. We heat out very little electrons, we feel a surface, and then I would expect a non-exponential decay, which would be interesting to be resolved by attosecond pump probe dynamics. Thanks for your patience. Thank you.
It's right here. You have to turn it on.
Thank you. I have a question about this HOMO of N2, which you presented. Can you show this again? One was obtained from the quantum chemistry program, and the other is probably from an experiment. But they look quite different. So the question is, what is the difference, and maybe we can learn something from this difference.
Here?
No, I mean this picture in the middle is different from...
Oh, that's the HOMO, yeah.
Yeah, this is HOMO which was obtained from GAMES program.
Right.
Yeah, and this is different from the upper one.
Well, the difference from the upper one is the exchange effect, the mixing with the lower lying orbitals. So this you clearly see here. When we take into account the top of the HOMO...
Yeah, so okay, the lower one is obtained by your calculations, yeah?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And you use the, at initial state, this wave function from HOMO program. You are calculating harmonic spectrum, yeah?
Yeah. From Gaussian. We use the orbitals from Gaussian.
Okay, thank you.
Is there a follow-up on this
point? The Corkin group use a plane wave dipole moment, and unfortunately plane wave is not orthogonal to a HOMO. That's a big problem. Now, did you use exactly the same projection onto plane wave?
Yeah, we use a plane wave.
Have you tried, we've shown in a paper in PhysRev that you cannot use plane wave for molecules. You get the wrong angular distribution of harmonics if you do that. But if you use the acceleration gauge in plane wave, it works very well. So have you thought of redoing calculation with acceleration gauge? It really depends on the gauge, it's this problem.
No, we haven't done that yet. No, the answer is no. But it should be checked out, I agree.
Which gauge did you use? Length gauge?
Well, we didn't use any gauge. You don't really need to...
You didn't calculate a dipole matrix element for the recombination step?
Sure. We did dipole matrix element, just like that.
So it's length gauge, okay.
Okay, if you want that.
Let's see, you had a follow-up on this.
What exactly do you call the HOMO? Usually this is either Hartree-Fock or Kohn-Sham, or do you mean the Dyson orbital?
Oh, the HOMO.
The HOMO is something
in this case,
model-dependent.
In N2 it's Hartree-Fock, because it's a rigid electron system, so Hartree-Fock works fairly well. We did also CI going beyond Hartree-Fock, but it doesn't change the result much.
Now, if you have just the many-body wave function, or let's say a good approximation to it, what is actually being imaged in the experiment? And in simple cases, this reduces to something like that looks very much like a Hartree-Fock orbital, let's say.
Right.
But let's say in more complicated cases, is that a Dyson orbital, that one?
Yes, exactly. So, well, so this here, in the multi-electron language, would be a Dyson orbital. And those are exchange effects between different orbitals, in the HOMO orbital and the lower-lying orbitals. So you have two contributions. But Dyson orbital is correct, but it's only part of the answer. Where? Yes. Yeah, that's true. So this is how we have treated it. How we have treated it numerically. But in our paper, we have derived the general ansatz. There you get the Dyson orbital plus something which our case is exchange effect, but then it's more complex.
I had a question about the tunnel ionization calculation. Most DFT calculations with approximate functionals, the position of the HOMO is not very accurate. It's off by a few EV. Would that be important for your I guess you had C60 plus, and you said you'd done a DFT calculation for that.
There. Well, only for the matching parameter. For the ionization potential, we take the experimental ionization potential. Otherwise, it would completely, I mean, if you're off by one EV, you would completely kill the calculation.
Right, that's why I was worried.
So usually when you calculate ionization using WKB, it's very easy to do that in one dimension and very tricky to do that in multiple dimensions. When you say that you're solving for this WKB wave function and matching it to the wave function, are you doing that one dimensionally, or how are you solving for the actual wave function in the tunneling region?
So what we do in this region is we describe the wave function as a function of the set coordinates and the momentum coordinates in perpendicular direction. And that makes it essentially one-dimensional in space. And for our three-dimensional matching wave function, we do the same. Out here we expand it one space dimensions and radial momentum dimensions. And by doing that, you transform the three-dimensional problem essentially in a one-dimensional space problem, and you can use the regular W2B theory. The matching point is very close to the surface, because close to the surface, polarization and the laser field cancel each other, so it's essentially field free, and that's the state where you can observe the HOMO undisturbed, most undisturbed.
For the one-dimensional helium calculation for the two electrons, could you comment on this, why this is so more difficult to get to convergence compared to the two-dimensional? I assume in the one-dimensional helium, you assume you use the smoothed Coulomb potential both for the electron-electron interaction and electron-nucleus interaction, and then everything should be very smooth and actually very rapidly converging. What's the problem there?
I would like to know too. I don't know. We were really surprised when we saw these results. But so we did that with two different codes. With one code where the electron-electron interaction is expanded in product functions, and with one code where the electron-electron interaction is done exactly by convolution. And both codes with the same results in one dimension, they don't converge to the exact result for some reason. I don't really know why. I don't know.
Any other questions? I might make one comment, which is that Zach Walters has a poster later today, and we will discuss at the poster some of the accuracy of the plane wave approximation if you want to stop by.
So have you compared your analytic ionization rate equation with the experimental result on using atomic gases, not the C60, for example, xenon or argon or something? Have you compared your grades well?
Oh, you would be surprised. The funny thing is, if you look at Corcoran's experiments, there is a small difference between the measurement and ADK theory. And our theory even explains this small difference. So it works really well. And it not only works for C60, it also works for benzene and other systems, which is still unpublished data. So it seems to work in a fairly broad range, actually.
So are you saying the ADK always overestimates rate, or?
In noble gases, I wouldn't know. This is a very subtle difference, so it's not really large. But usually, it always overestimates, because ADK doesn't account for the angular momentum barrier, and it doesn't account for the polarizability. And both effects reduce the tunnel ionization rate.
Thank you.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again.